Hello, I'm Carl Gerichter. I'm a compulsive overeater. I give you my last name because the tradition of anonymity doesn't mean you can't know who I am. I've started saying at meetings lately that this is my family, and if you guys don't know who I am, then nobody knows who I am. And if I get sick and I end up in the hospital, you're not going to find Carl G. You need my last name. So my last name is Gerichter. And I'm proud to be a member of Overeaters Anonymous, and I'll tell anybody in the world that I'm a member of Overeaters Anonymous because this program saved my life. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I come from what I like to call a normal dysfunctional family, as I think they're all pretty much dysfunctional. My mother was ill most of my childhood while I was growing up. She was recovering behind a closed bedroom door from one operation or another, and my father was a very good man with a very bad temper. And, with my 20/20 hindsight, I can look back and I can see that my father was in great fear of losing my mother. And that fear turned to anger, and that anger turned to rage, and that rage was typically taken out on me because I was the youngest. And my sister, who's 3 years older than I am, somehow was able to diffuse the anger with laughter. I cried. And when I cried, I was told, you cry, I'll give you something to cry for. And that only made me cry more. I was talking with someone the other day, with my daughter actually, and we were talking about the Wicked Witch of the West and how scary the Wicked Witch of the West was, and I'll get you, my pretty, and all that stuff. And I said, no, the scariest thing I ever heard was I'll kill you with my bare hands. And that was my father when I was 4 years old, because he got angry at me because I was running up and down the halls making noise and upsetting my mother by that noise because she was recovering behind a closed door. To this day, those are the scariest words I've ever heard. I'll kill you with my bare hands. I can picture my father coming at me and telling me he was going to kill me. And at 4 years old, you got to believe it. So I learned very early on that it wasn't safe to feel or express feelings in my household, good, bad, or indifferent. And I found out that food would take away the feelings. I never used food to make me feel good. And I've heard people over and over in the years I've been in programs saying, I used food to make me feel good. I used food to make me not feel. Because I could be beaten for feeling good just as well as I could be beaten for feeling bad and crying. Because if I was jubilant and making too much noise, I would be beaten for that as well. So I just didn't want to feel anything. And I used food to zone out. Steal money from my mother's purse or my grandmother's purse or my father's trousers when he was not around and go out and buy stuff. I would steal food from the kitchen, from the freezer. I'd eat frozen, whatever it was, didn't matter. And I'd get chubby, I'd get chunky, but I was never obese as a child. I've got pictures here of what I looked like when I was heavy. I wasn't heavy as a child because my mother controlled my food pretty much. And there was only so much I could steal as a kid. And when I got a little chubby, a little chunky, whatever it was, my mom would put me on a diet, and I'd do the diet, and I'd lose whatever weight that was, and that would be fine for a while, and it would creep up again, and then she put me on another diet. And so I was not obese as a child, but I was a compulsive overeater. I would go to the local store, and I would buy a cake, and I would take it home, and I would hide it in my closet. And I would eat that cake until it was gone, little pieces at a time, little pieces at a time. But I was compulsive overeater. There's a story I tell every time I speak, and I'm sorry for those of you that just heard me speak a couple days ago. Same story. My mother is a fantastic baker. She used to make these huge vats of cookies, and I'd get up in the middle of the night, and I'd go into the kitchen, and I'd take this thing and I'd open it up and I'd look at the top layer, memorize what it looked like, eat a couple layers down to make it look like nobody touched it. And I'd put it away. But the thing that my mother makes that I liked the best was cream puffs. She made these cream puffs with a pastry shell filled with thick yellow custard and a little pastry shell on top of powdered sugar on them. I love these things. And I came home from school one day. I was 9 years old. On a Thursday afternoon, and she was making these cream puffs, and I walked in the kitchen and I said, oh, cream puffs, can I have one? She said, no, you can't have one. They're for a party tomorrow night. If there are any left after the party, then you can have one. First thing that went through my brain was, how could there possibly be a cream puff left after a party? I knew if it were my party, there wouldn't be any cream puffs left. And the second thing that went through my head is, well, I'll just get up in the middle of the night and I'll steal them, because that's what I did around food. But my mother knew I had this problem. She knew. And this is, well, I was 9 years old in 1960, so it's just about the same time that Overeaters Anonymous was born. She said, don't steal any, they're counted. Now, in my household, with my father, I've learned, you do something you've been specifically not told not to do, you will be beaten for it. I mean, it's never been said, but that's what happens. And the worst punishment my mother ever meted out to me when I was growing up was wait for your father to come home. So I knew that if I got up now and in the middle of the night and stole one of these cream puffs, that I was going to get a beating, because that's what happened. But I wanted one of those cream puffs. I could not figure out how to have a cream puff and not get a beating. The only thing I could figure out how to do was to postpone that beating 24 hours. And that's what I did. I got up in the middle of the night. I went into the kitchen. I opened the refrigerator. I took the tray of cream puffs out, put it on the counter. I went into the drawer, got a spoon, took the tops off the cream puffs, and ate the filling out of every single one of them. Licked off the spoon, put it back in the drawer, put the little tops on so you couldn't tell they'd been touched, put it back in the refrigerator, went back to sleep. Got up the next morning, went to school, came home, had dinner, went to sleep. And it wasn't noticed that the cream puffs had been touched until that night at the party when people started taking bites out of this empty pastry, by which time I was already in bed asleep. And the next morning, my father beat the shit out of me for two things. One was for touching the cream puffs, and the other was for embarrassing them in front of their friends. And that's this disease that I have. I knew I was putting myself in for physical bodily harm, and I couldn't stop myself from touching this food at 9 years old. I have a disease. It wants to kill me. It wanted to kill me then. It wants to kill me now. There is no cure for this disease I have. That's one of the reasons I keep coming back here. Because I can't do this by myself. So, I started gaining weight when I was 18 years old and I left home. Because my parents wanted to charge me rent to live in a bedroom of their apartment where I wasn't allowed to play my records or my guitar or smoke my marijuana or anything else a normal 18-year-old did in 1967-68. So I left. And I found a friend who was in a similar situation. I took my $55 that my parents were going to charge me, and he took $55, and we rented a two-bedroom house in North Hollywood. And I moved out. Well, what I didn't take into account was when I was living at home and paying $55 a month, my mother would feed me. My roommate wasn't going to feed me. I have an ex-employer that used to tell me he'd rather clothe me than feed me. So I had to start feeding myself, and I wasn't very good at it, and I didn't know how to do that because I'd never had to. So it would not be unusual for me to buy a bag of potatoes and just slice them into a frying pan and eat until I couldn't eat anymore. I'd go to the local McDonald's at closing time and beg for the food that was under the heat lamps that they were going to throw in the trash. They'd give me these great big bags of greasy hamburgers and french fries, and I'd eat the whole bag. To me, a single serving is a package. A two-pound bag of M&Ms is a single-serving package. That's it. It's a package. That's a serving. And however big the serving is, that's it. From the time I was 18 years old until the time I was 40 years old, I weighed more every year. And every year, I got to hate myself more and more. I got married in 1978. The woman I married is a compulsive overeater. And the basis of our marriage was food. That's what we did for fun. We were binge buddies. And there was a strict competition. She couldn't have a grain of rice more than I did. And I couldn't have a cookie more than she had. And that's when I started doing more and more secret eating, because I couldn't let her see what I was eating. I had my own business. I was in the service business. And I would go from service call to service call, stopping someplace to get something to eat. And I'd have theme days. I was in the San Fernando Valley. So one day I'd eat chili dogs between each. And one day I'd stop and I'd buy a little pound cake. And that was daily. And I just was getting fatter and fatter and fatter and fatter. But, that didn't stop me. I just got up every morning, went into the bathroom, looked in the mirror and said, okay, you piece of shit, go to work now. Because that's what I thought of myself. I wasn't happy in my marriage, but that was what I had. I deserved everything I got in life, good or bad, mostly bad, and it was my fault because that's what I'd been told all my, growing up. My father's messages are the messages I played to myself. My father used to tell me I was stupid. I had no brains. If we were playing cards and I was winning, he would tell me I had more luck than brains. And I believed this. I got through school fairly well without studying. I didn't apply myself, but I passed. I wasn't an A student or anything, but I got by. I didn't like school. I hated high school. I hated high school with a passion. I still have never gone to a school reunion. And not because I have anything against the people that were there. I had no friends there. I was a loner. So there was nobody I really cared to go back and see because there's nothing there. My friends were from a summer camp that I went to when I was 13 and 14 years old for the summer. And then from the time I was 15 until the time I was 23, I worked there for 8 summers. Because that was my family. As you guys are now my family today, that was my family then. Those were the people that would show me love and acceptance without any requirements. And the fact that you could eat as much as you wanted to at camp was also fun. You want more? Just go get more. So that was good. I reached a point where I could not stop eating. I was eating from the time I got up every morning until the time I went to bed at night, except when I was actually physically doing something else with my hands. I would get up in the morning, and I opened my business about 4 miles from where I lived because I didn't want to commute. And I would get up, I would go in the bathroom, do my morning affirmations, piece of shit, go to work, and then I would get dressed and I would go to work. And I'd stop at the donut shop on the way to work every morning and pick up a half a dozen donuts because those half a dozen donuts would get me from the donut shop to work. 4 miles, less than 4 miles from the donut shop. And that half a dozen donuts would be gone. Then, if I didn't have any service calls, then it was time for breakfast. And I'd get this bowl and the cereal and the milk. You know the routine. You pour in the cereal, you pour in the milk. You eat, oh, there's milk left over. You pour in more cereal, you pour in more milk. Oh. And you do this until either the milk or the cereal is gone, and then breakfast is over. And again, single serving package. And then I would go run my service calls and stop someplace in between each service call and get something to eat. I have a friend in this program that some time ago said at a meeting I heard, and I repeat this because it's a good illustration. A compulsive overeater is someone that cannot get from point A to point B without food. And that was me. I couldn't get from one service call to the next without eating something. Whatever it happened to be. And then I'd come back into the shop and have lunch with my wife. She worked with me. And then I'd do the same thing in the afternoon. If there were no service calls in the afternoon, where my store was at, there was a shopping center and there was a market. I'd go and I'd buy milk and cookies. Again, single serving package. And then when that was over and it was time to go home, my wife would go home before me so that she could go prepare dinner. And I would, again, 4 miles to get home, I'd stop and pick up a couple cheeseburgers on the way home to get me there. And then I'd have dinner with my wife. And then we'd, binge on whatever was, to be binged. And then I'd go to sleep. Except I didn't sleep. Because I'd wake up because I either stopped breathing because there was so much pressure on my chest, or I'd wake up spontaneously vomiting into my own throat because I'd shoved so much food into my body, I just didn't want to stay down. This was my daily life. I was always looking for the answer. What's going to fix me? What's going to make me a good person? Again, I've always been told I was a bad person and everything was my fault. So I was always looking for the fix, and I always thought that maybe money would fix me. In September of 1988, I won a contest on a radio station, and I had $36,000 all at one time. And the day I won that money, I was a happy kid. It was great. But after paying Uncle Sam his fair share and paying off some debts and funding IRAs for the year and buying some new equipment for my business and buying some equipment for my wife's business, the money was gone. And I wasn't fixed. I still couldn't stop eating. I still got up every morning and called myself a piece of shit. And it wasn't any good. And I'm so grateful that that happened, because that was a good step down towards my bottom. And I needed to reach a bottom, and I was getting there. 6 months later, on the same radio station coincidentally, I heard an advertisement for an eating disorder unit that said that you have a disease and it's not your fault and there's help. Now, for me, this was all brand new information, because, again, I was always told it was my fault. I had no willpower. I was no good. I was defective. And just push yourself away from the table and say, no, I can't do that. So I picked up the phone and I called, because it was a free 800 number. If I'd had to pay for the call, I never would have called them. I called them. I didn't ask them what their program was. I asked them how much. And I did that because, being a self-employed obese person, I had learned that there was no health insurance available for an obese person that my insurance would pay for. So I hung up the phone, because there was no way in the world I could afford the kind of money they were asking, and reached my bottom. I was done. I had no place to go. I knew at that point that I was never going to be able to stop eating. I was never going to lose weight. I went into my closet. I threw away all the clothing I had hanging there that didn't fit anymore, some of which had been hanging there for 20 years, threw it all away, and figured I was just going to eat and eat and eat until I died, and the sooner the better. And I proceeded to try to do that. And I did. I was numb for the next 6 months, completely numb. I could not feel a thing. I remember feeling anger and rage now and again, but, you know, I was not a happy camper. I was a very angry man. In fact, there was a hole in my living room ceiling from a bottle of Diet Right soda that I threw at the floor, hard enough for it to bounce up and put a hole in the ceiling. Anyway, 6 months later, in September of 1989, now, a year after the money, my mother called me and said that she had talked to this eating disorder unit, and they had an outpatient program, and that if I wanted to go to the outpatient program, she would pay for it. I wasn't on real good terms with my mom at the time, and the only thing I can attribute my answer to was a higher power I wasn't even aware I had yet, as I said yes instead of stick it where the sun don't shine. And I picked up the phone, and now I call them to ask what their program was. And what it was a lot of group therapy. And the requirement wasn't an option, the requirement that I go to at least one Overeaters Anonymous meeting a week. They told me when I started that the recovery program of the eating disorder unit is to help me get on my road to recovery, and it ends in 6 months. And your disease goes on forever. You need to get into OA. You need to get into your support. You need to get your sponsor. You need to get your people. And you need to start working the program before you leave here. They required I go to one meeting a week at least. And at that meeting, I had to have the secretary fill out a little piece of paper saying I'd been there and take it back to them. If I wasn't willing to do that, I could not be part of their program. I was at my bottom. I was willing to do whatever I was told to do. I went to my first meeting on a Sunday afternoon in September of 1989, at the Valley office. They had the 12 steps up on the wall in there, and I read the first steps, and we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. I was like, yeah, that's me. That was an illustration of me. I could have been a poster boy for step one. My life is totally unmanageable, and I could not stop eating. See, I never came here to lose weight. I came here because I couldn't stop eating. It wasn't about the weight for me, because I never figured I was going to lose weight. I just wanted to be able to stop eating, because I couldn't take it anymore. You know, I'm an addict. And the addiction process, as most of you know because you're here, is that after a period of time, you need more of the drug to get the same effect. Well, when I'm eating 24 hours a day and it's not working anymore, what do I do? What do I do? I can't eat any more than I'm already eating. What do I do? I didn't know about bulimia then. So if I had, I probably would have tried that. But I didn't know what to do. So I went there, and I was abstinent when I walked in that room. The eating disorder unit had given me a food plan. I started doing that food plan, white-knuckling it. And when I got to my first meeting, and I pitched about a tuna fish sub, you don't have to eat this way forever. Maybe someday when you reach your goal weight, you can have a tuna submarine sandwich. And it was like, yeah, that's what they've been telling me over and over again, but it didn't sink in. One day at a time. I only have to do today. I can't do tomorrow yet. And the obsession for the food was gone. And that was a little miracle for me. My first real, that I call a real spiritual experience, was a few weeks after I got into the program. I was at some lady's house doing some work for work, and I was walking through her kitchen, and on her kitchen counter were these two world's finest chocolate bars. You know what these are, I don't have to describe them. Kids used to come into my shop selling them, and I'd buy a dozen of them. They'd be gone a day, day and a half max. I used to tell them when I was a kid that was my best customer. Then they were 50 cents and one and a half times the size they are today. I'm still sick. That's why I'm still here, guys. I saw that the chocolate bars on this kitchen counter, and I froze. I mean, I literally was rooted to the floor. I couldn't move. I started to salivate. My stomach started grumbling. My mouth started to water. I started shaking. I got a headache. I wanted that chocolate more than I wanted life itself, and it was making me absolutely crazy. I didn't know what to do. I closed my eyes, and I clenched my fists. I said, God, take this from me. I can't handle it. And it was all gone. All those symptoms were gone. The desire for the chocolate was gone. And I felt peace come over my body. And I knew then that I had a higher power, personally for me, Carl, that would take care of me whenever I needed help. And all I had to do to tap into that limitless power was to humble myself and say, God, I can't do this. Please help me. And from that day to this, when I have been willing, and that's important, when I have been willing to accept the help, it has been there for me. I'm not always willing. I wish I had the willingness today that I had 12 years ago when I walked into these rooms. Today, if I don't have God in my life, it's not because God went somewhere. God doesn't take vacations for me. God is always with me. If I don't have God in my life, it's because I turned around and walked away. And when that happens, I have to stop in my tracks, I have to retrace my steps, and I have to go back and say, here I am, God, take me. Because I can't do this. God does for me what I cannot do for myself. It pisses me off sometimes that he doesn't do what I can do, because it would be so much easier if he did. But he doesn't, but he does do what I can't do. What I can't do today is leave food on my plate. It happens once in a while. It's a spiritual experience when it does. It's a spiritual experience for me every time I go into a restaurant and ask for a to-go box before the food gets there and put half of it in the box. Because typically restaurants serve too much food. My experience. What's too much food? I got a sponsor after about a month in the program. I was only going to one meeting a week because I was in group therapy four nights a week with this eating disorder unit. And at that particular meeting I was going to, there were no men who were sponsors. And the first Friday night, a man showed up and said he was a sponsor. I grabbed him and said, can you sponsor me? And he says, oh, yeah, sure. Call me tomorrow morning. Tell me what you're going to eat for the next 24 hours. Read 2 pages of the big book. Highlight what interests you or what you can relate to. Call me when you call me here with your food. We'll discuss what that is. And we'll do that for about a month, and then we'll start working the steps. And I said, okay. And I did that. I was willing to do whatever I was told. Today, when I talk to my sponsor and he tells me to do something, you know what? I'm still willing to do whatever I'm told when my sponsor tells me to do it. I'm working on my 8th step. I'm writing paragraphs, 20 every day now. This is not my first 8th step. I've done a few of them over the years. But the longer I'm abstinent, the more stuff I remember. And sometimes I pick up stuff that I should have done a 10th step on, and I didn't. So I get to do an 8th step on it. One of the perfect things about this program is that I don't have to be perfect. And I can make mistakes, and I can take care of those mistakes. Anyway, so I started working the steps with my sponsor, still doing this eating plan that the eating disorder unit had given me. go figure, I started losing weight. I was eating 3 meals a day and a snack every day, and I was losing weight. And I started to learn what a serving was according to what the package said, not what the package had in it. It's a difference. And sometimes I would obsess about a food. I remember, it was a Hershey's Kiss with an almond in the middle of it. They came out after I got abstinent, and at the time I was abstaining from sugar, and I was obsessing about this, and I had to go to the market to pick up a bag of potatoes, and I called up my sponsor and said, you know what? I want to commit to you. I'm just going to buy a bag of potatoes at the market. I'm not going to buy anything else. I didn't even have to tell him what I was obsessing about. But it's just to make the commitment that that's all I'm going to do. And I went to the market and I bought my potatoes. That was the end of the story. 6 months after I got into the program, I had already worked my fourth step, my fifth step. I'm working on my seventh and eighth. And I'd already lost 100 pounds in the first 6 months. 10 months after I came into the program, I'd lost 135 pounds, and I was past my goal weight. I couldn't stop losing weight. I had to start adding food back into my food plan and kind of even off, which I did. It took a few months to do that, and I maintained, I lost more than 135 because I couldn't stop losing weight. But I maintained 135-pound weight loss for a good number of years. I'm not maintaining that today. I've gained back probably 20 pounds in the last 6 years. My doctor says you're over 50 now, and your thyroid's starting to slow down, and you're starting to slow down, and you might need to make some changes. And I haven't quite been willing enough to let go of enough food to maintain 135-pound weight loss. I'm still maintaining over 100-pound weight loss for 11 years. I've been in program and abstinent for just over 12 years. In September, I celebrated my 12th birthday. I've enjoyed the differences in my life today. I've enjoyed the 20 pounds hasn't made enough difference that I have to buy a larger shirt. I'm wearing a medium shirt. When I was growing up, I went from boys large to men's large. I never wore medium. So I have some work shirts that I bought when I was going down, figuring I would stop at large, and I didn't. So I have some large work shirts, and I also have some medium shirts. Most of my shirts are medium. I wear large t-shirts because they're loose and more comfortable, but this is a medium. That just blows me away. When I was at 135 pounds, less than my top weight, which my top weight that I can remember was like 312 pounds, I wore a size 33, 34 jeans when I was down to that weight. Today, I wear a size 34. I can't get into the 33s. You know, life is tough. But you know, there were things that went on when I was heavy that gave me that feeling that we read about in the big book, that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, that those of us that have had 100 pounds or more to lose get to have, that people that aren't 100-pounders, thank God, don't get to experience. Things like not being able to use a public restroom because the stall is too small. Things like not being able to fit in an airplane seat because it's too small. Turnstiles. Booths in restaurants, people's cars, the physical limitations of the disease are sometimes unbearable. One of the most humiliating for me was a trip to Disneyland. I love Disneyland. Today I'm an annual pass holder. I go as many times a year as I possibly can. And about this particular time was within the year before I came into program, I think it was. It was the first time I'd ever seen Star Tours, and I waited in this long line to go on this ride, and I sat down in the back row, and they said, fasten your seatbelt, and I took the seatbelt, and it wouldn't reach. Now, I wasn't familiar with the ride. I just figured, okay, I'll just hold on to it. Nobody will ever know. They have this little box up in the front with all these little lights on that tell which seat does not have their seatbelt fastened. And the guy went down, looked at the little box. I didn't know what he was doing, but I was watching him. And he looked at the little lights, and saw, I guess he saw that my light wasn't on. And he looked up at me, and he stopped, and he went and he got an extension belt. held it up in front of the entire room of people and said, "Sir, you need to wear this." And he walked up to me with it. I felt about this big. I did not enjoy the ride that day. So I get a lump in my throat just thinking about that. It was not fun. When I started in the eating disorder unit, the primary therapist I had asked me, what's your daily routine? What do you do? I said, well, I go in the bathroom. I say, piece of shit, go to work now, and I get dressed in the morning. He said, well, you got to stop that. He says, you got to take that tape out of your tape player, throw it in the trash, never to be retrieved again, and I'll give you a new tape to put in your tape player. He says, this is what you got to do tomorrow morning, Carl. He says, I want you to go into the bathroom, stand in front of the mirror naked, caress the parts of your body you don't like, and this is what you got to say. You got to say, good morning, Carl. You're a handsome man. You're intelligent. You're competent. You're capable. You're a wonderful human being. You're a nice guy. You're talented. You're valuable. You have a great deal to offer. You're a good person. You're sexy. You're a loving, precious child of God. You look the way you need to look. You weigh what you need to weigh. And I love you very much. And give yourself a hug. I looked at him and said, bullshit. I'm not going to do that. I don't believe it. It's not true. I'm not going to do it. He said, Carl, you don't have to believe that it's true. All you have to do is act as if you believe it's true. I've learned in these rooms I cannot think myself into good actions, but I can act myself into good thinking. I said, well, if I do that tomorrow morning and I don't like it, then what? He says, if you do it tomorrow and you don't like it, well, do it the next day. If you don't like doing it the next day, do it the next day. So I did it that next morning, and believe me, at 312 pounds, it wasn't a pretty sight, and I hated every second of it. It wasn't true. I didn't believe it, but I did it. And I hated it. And I did it the next morning, and I hated it. And I did it the next morning, and I hated it. And I did it this morning. It was okay. And I did it every morning in between as well. The difference is that when I did it this morning, and yesterday morning, and the morning before, and probably every morning for the last 10 years or so, I believed it because it was all true. And what I've come to realize after 12 years of doing this is that it was all true on the very first day that I did it at 312 pounds in front of the mirror. Because on that day, I was starting on a path of recovery, and I had to be exactly where I was on that path. I could not have been anywhere else. I could not have looked like anything else. I could not have weighed anything else. And I had to be able to accept myself for what I was in order to change to what I am. Acceptance is the key. It says so in the big book. It says a lot of things. Willingness is the key. Acceptance is the key. They're all the key. A lot of keys. And I'm a locksmith for a living, so I deal with the key. What the program has taught me over the years is that I have to do a lot of the same things I did 12 years ago. Things I do today on a daily basis. I get up in the morning. When I wake up, I hit the floor on my knees, and I pray. I thank God for my life, for my abstinence, my weight loss, my recovery, people in my life today who love me and care about me, the roof over my head. I thank him for everything that I have in my life today, because without God, I would have nothing. I would be nothing. I ask him to help me with my food. I ask him to help me be of service to my fellows, to treat my fellows with compassion, kindness, understanding, tolerance, and patience, to help me serve my fellows, and to help those that still suffer. I say that prayer every day, in the morning. I also pray before every meal. For me, God has to come before the food. And the last thing I do at night, after I do a tenth step, is pretty much the same prayer, except I'm thanking God for my day instead of asking for help. Once I'm done with my prayers in the morning, I go and I read a couple pages of the big book. I still do that. I read a little meditation book. If I have a writing assignment, I do my reading and writing assignment for my sponsor. And I go to work, and I do my day. I call my sponsor every day. I don't always talk to him. I talk to his machine most of the time, but I'm making that contact. I still call my food in every day. Anything I want to eat today includes sugar, includes white flour, includes sometimes eating between meals. But it does not include something that I have not told somebody about or that I didn't tell somebody about after the fact. I've did that as well. There are some things I haven't chosen to eat in 12 years. I haven't had a donut in 12 years. I haven't ordered fried chicken in 12 years. I don't order French fries. I don't order onion rings. I ate very low fat today. I can't remember the last time I used butter or margarine on anything. I use fat-free salad dressings and mayonnaise. It's just, that's what works for me. The third benefit I get from that phone call is a daily contact with another compulsive overeater, which is the basis of the program, is one compulsive overeater. Talking with another compulsive overeater, together we can recover. Because this program is not an I program, it's a we program. Every single one of the steps has to be worked with somebody. We admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves, not myself, it's ourselves. This is a we program. I cannot work this without a sponsor. The fourth benefit I get for that phone call is a daily reminder that I'm not normal. I look pretty normal today. But I'm not. I still can do some pretty strange things around food. And that's why I need to be accountable for my food. I like frozen yogurt. I at one point a couple years back, I thought, you know what? I spend a couple dollars and go to the frozen yogurt store. I could buy one of those machines, save tons of money, and have it in my kitchen. Because it's economically feasible to do that. And and then the second thing that went through my head is, you know what? I bet the stuff would spoil before I ate enough of those cups. And then the third thing that went through my head is, no, I bet I could eat all of it before it spoiled. That was the end of the frozen yogurt at home idea. So, I'm not well. Finn is not well. So, I have to remember that. Because it says in the literature that the idea we can eat like normal people has to be smashed. Well, I've always been able to eat like a normal person. Not been my problem. My problem is I can't stop like a normal person. So I make that phone call. I talk to the people I sponsor, or New Days. I've got a sponsor that a sponsee that I email. I talk to him once in a blue moon when he's got to read me some writing. We'll get together. But he lives in Lancaster. I live in the Valley. And the phone calls are just too expensive for him. And you know what? If it works, it works. So we do that. All the years I've spent in this program, I've done a lot of service. I've been on the Region 2 board for a number of years. I did an intergroup board. I've been involved in the OA birthday party plays for 10, 11 years. I don't know. This year they're not having one. This will be the first year since 1991 that I haven't been involved in it. It's been a joy. Service to me is part of not only the tools, but it's also part of, for me, of the seventh tradition. I have to be able to give back what I'm getting, and that's part of the seventh tradition, is to support the program financially and through my service. So I get to do both. I don't have to do both. I get to do both. When I first came here, and before I came here, as I said, I was always trying to find out how to become that good person, and I was never able to do it. Well, 12 years after coming into these rooms, I'm still powerless over food. My life is still unmanageable. But I now have people who can help me, tools that can help me, and a fellowship that can help me. And I found out that it's not about being a bad person trying to get good. It's about I'm a sick person trying to get well. And that's why I'm here. And thanks for letting me share.
Yeah. We have a few minutes. If there's any questions, just try to repeat the question.
Okay. Any questions?
Hi, I'm Daryl. I'm a compulsive overeater. Carl, can you talk about how you stayed so committed to service over all these years?
The question is how I stayed committed to service over all these years. Service, you hear service is its own reward. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, sometimes it's a pain in the butt, but you know what? This program saved my life. I would be dead by now. 12 years of eating the way I was eating 12 years ago, I wouldn't be alive today. I owe it to this fellowship to give service, to be of service. And I don't regret a minute of it. A lot of it's been a lot of fun. A lot of it's been hard work. The OA plays were a kick. Being a Region 2 treasurer for 4 years is a lot of work. When it was done, I was ready for it to be done. But it's well worth it. I met so many people doing service. There, you know, in the birthday party plays, there's not a meeting room I can walk into someplace somewhere where I don't run across someone that I've been in a show with, that we had a similar experience. I can't think of a meeting I've gone to where there's not been someone. I was in a meeting last Tuesday night, same thing. I was in a meeting Wednesday night, same thing. There's somebody there that I know that I've done service with. I have so many connections from the service I've done. And I still get phone call. I got a phone call today from somebody on the Region 2 board wanting to ask me a question about something that went on a couple of years ago because the people that were on the board then aren't now, and they don't know what went on. But, you know, so it's all worthwhile information that I've picked up over the years. How I stay committed, God. It's God works my life today. God does for me what I can't do for myself. So, like, if I need a service commitment, I go and I ask for one. Today, the only service commitment I have is I'm a secretary of my home meeting. I don't get to a lot of meetings today because my work schedule leaves me so tired. I'm up at 5 o'clock in the morning. By the time I get a chance to go to meetings, I'm falling asleep. So I don't get to a lot of meetings to give that type of service. I speak when I can. That's a way of giving service. I'll clean up chairs. It doesn't matter. The level of service doesn't matter. All that matters is I'm giving back what was given to me freely. This program, these rooms, are the only place in this world I have ever, ever in my life found people who want me to succeed and are asking for nothing in return. The Fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous. I love it. Answer your question.
Hi.
Hi.
My name's Bill.
Hi, Bill.
The day my program fell apart is the day I changed sponsors and was calling my food to communicate voice on the day. I was no longer talking. That did happen to me.
No, I have a sponsee that I'm emailing. My food, I call into somebody. I talk to them a couple times a week usually. But for calling in my food, the question is what, you had a question attached?
Really a question.
How that works for me? Yeah, the gentleman was saying that calling in his food to a tape machine wasn't working for him. If it's not working for you, find a human. Simple. There are tons of people who stand up and say they're food sponsors. Call somebody. For me, it doesn't really matter. I know the person's going to listen to the tape machine. And if it's something really off the wall, I don't call my food sponsor about it. I call my step sponsor about it. And because the guy that's listening to my food is just so I can be honest about it. I'm not looking for feedback. I know what I'm eating. I'm not looking for feedback or criticism about my food. If I have a problem with food, I talk to my step sponsor I'm working the steps with. I'm committing my food to somebody to commit my food to. Two different people.
One more quick question.
I call my food in the day before for the next 24 hours. Sometimes it changes. Sometimes I don't know, and I'll say, I'm going to call you from the restaurant, or I'll call you after. Or I think it's going to be this, and if it's something radically different, I'll call you. Or I'll say I'm going someplace with a bunch of program people, I will give my food for dinner to one of those people. Okay, thank you.